Welcome to the Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. This is part two of our 2025 Faces of the Industry. This National Electricity Month, Electricity Canada is introducing you to the people who are the faces of the industry. Electricity Canada's Faces of the Industry Award highlights the work of six industry professionals who have demonstrated leadership in every aspect of the electricity sector. We created the Faces of the Industry Award last year, and it came out of a simple but powerful premise. The electricity sector aren't just companies, they're people. The great thing about Faces is it's a real grassroots campaign. We had 47 nominations for the award this year, representing people from all parts of the electricity sector and from every region. All we ask for is for the recipient to demonstrate innovation, leadership, and outstanding achievement in their field. This year's award winners have been selected from every region of Canada and come from every part of the industry, including executive leadership, finance, engineering, line work, and procurement. What they all have in common is leadership and innovation, and of course, their work in the electricity sector. I had the privilege of talking to all of this year's Faces of the Industry recipients for the Flux Capacitor, and it was humbling to realize the breadth of experience and talent the electricity sector possesses. I hope that you'll experience this for yourself as you listen to my conversations with this year's Faces of the Industry. On the pod today, the second batch of three of those Faces of the Industry. First up on the podcast is...
Jennifer Williams, Newfoundland and Labrador Hydro, and I'm the president and CEO.
Jennifer, first off, congratulations on being a recipient of this year's Faces of the Industry.
Thank you so much. Quite honored to represent my organization.
So why don't we start off just for, you know, for interest's sake, President and CEO of Newfoundland and Labrador Hydro. It's been a big year for Newfoundland and Labrador Hydro. It's been a big year for you. The negotiations that have led to a new deal after decades and decades. Maybe for the listener, talk a little bit about, you know, what it was like to be involved in that process, and you know, and what is this new deal going to mean for the company and for the people of Newfoundland and Labrador?
Sure. The existing contract between Newfoundland and Labrador Hydro, Hydro is a majority owner of CFLCO, so Churchill Falls.
Churchill Falls and Labrador Corporation.
So we are the majority owner, with Hydro Quebec being the minority owner. Mm-hmm. We own about 2/3, they own about 1/3. And the original contract essentially was a fixed price contract at a very low price set really, you know, 50-ish years ago, with some evolution since.
Yep.
But incredibly low. And through the changes of our history and electricity markets, Hydro Quebec had excess capacity or excess energy in its system that it could sell for a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so that has been really, really tough for the people in our province, in the psyche of pretty much everybody in the province, mm-hmm. To sort of see that happen when they really felt it was unfair. Our province had taken that to court several times to no joy. Mm-hmm. And so it had been a really tough thing hanging over the psyche of a lot of people in the province. So to have the opportunity, you know, at the leadership really of our Premier Fury and Premier Legault to say, this is a new day, it's a new world, can we do something together? We're neighbors, we should be able to do something. Mm-hmm. If it makes sense for both of us, can we do this? And I'm being in the role that I'm in, I was afforded the opportunity to be a primary participant in figuring out what's possible between us.
Right.
So when you consider that I grew up in this province where that's the psyche, I'm 52, mm-hmm. your whole life, everybody around you, there's been such angst about this.
Sure.
And have the opportunity to participate and to see something come to fruition through our hard work that really changes everything for us for the next 50 years. It is an honor. It is a privilege, but it's not something that we were gifted. Like, we earned this moment.
Yeah.
And I'm just so happy to have been a part of it.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, you say it's going to change everything for the future.
Mm-hmm.
What's that change going to look like? Because it really will change.
It really will change. So right now, as the majority owner of that plant, and the dollar value in dividends that goes back to the province is less than $20 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have continued for the next 17 years. That's when the contract would end.
Right.
In the first year, there'll be hundreds of millions of dollars that will go back to the province. And that actually started January 1st of this year. Got to get definitive agreements. There'll be a retroactive payment. But then within 10 years, it's about $1 billion a year instead of zero, essentially. So for the first 17 years of this new relationship, there'll be $17 billion back to Treasury instead of almost nothing.
Right.
That is huge for a very small province. And that number grows every single year after that. So this is truly province changing financial benefit just for the existing plant. In addition to having a new contract for the existing plant that extends out, it makes sense for Quebec too, to 2075. We're going to build new assets in Labrador. Well in excess of $30 billion worth of new construction, and therefore the economic benefit that comes with that. And then Quebec will get, you know, the majority of the power that comes out of that. But we will get also, because of all of the assets together, we're going to get about four times the power from those all of those assets combined than we currently have. So we'll have additional economic benefit and growth that can happen associated with that. So new contract, brand new pricing starting now, and then you know, tens of billions of dollars worth of construction, access to power. It is really, it is astounding what we're going to be able to do to change everything about the province and really the region, and I would argue the country.
Right. And, you know, given that we're talking, for example, about the previous contract that's five decades ago, these are not short-term assets, right? When you're talking about building new plant, this is generations to come.
It's generations to come. And, you know, certainly what we've seen in this industry, a concern that has been floated in our province, which we always knew was going to be a concern, so we've engineered in solutions to the new contract go forward, is, you know, how are we going to price the electricity now go forward? So for the existing assets, we're essentially tying tying the price to several markets as opposed to a fixed price with an escalator or just a single market, just say the cross-border market into the United States. We're tying the price, you know, some proportion, and that's to be negotiated, to several markets because we have no idea what the industry is going to look like.
Right.
Nobody does. I mean, who knew about tariffs? Who knew how much electrification was going to have an impact 5-10 years ago? So we certainly don't know what's going to happen over the long term. And so we had to do something that would allow for the value of these assets, or Churchill Falls itself, to change over time with what the value is in the market. So we're going to attach us. It's like a mutual fund, we basically describe it as. Instead of attaching yourself to one stock or one investment, we're attaching ourselves to several stocks so that it really does it float with the value in the market.
Right.
With the market being Quebec's replacement cost, Quebec's new supply cost, cross-border,
What's happening
prices.
In New England? What's happening at PJM?
All of those things will be part of the formula that will develop the price.
Well, that kind of...
Pretty novel.
It is. It is very novel. One of the things I ask folks that come on the podcast, Jennifer, is about their journey. So I'll make the same joke. When you were a little kid on the playground, did you always dream of running a company like Newfoundland Labrador Hydro?
No, I don't know what I dreamed of. So
what's your journey?
Yeah, I'm from a very big family. I'm the youngest of eight kids.
Okay.
My second oldest brother is an engineer. Some cousins that are older than me are engineers. My sister's husband is an engineer. So engineering had a presence in my life, but who really knows what engineering is until you're kind of into it. But it just, because of some of my academic ability, I was, you know, encouraged to do this kind of a path. And then, so did engineering. And then when I was graduating engineering, Newfoundland Power at home, which is a Fortis company, they hired me and put me on, I'm a civil engineer, so they put me on the construction of a very small hydro plant, the first one that had been built in a long time.
Oh, wow.
So that was appealing to me.
Yeah.
And so I did that. And it was a little 6-megawatt plant, and here we're talking about Churchill Falls, 5,400 megawatts.
Yeah,
so the bookends of that are pretty neat.
Which plant was that?
Rose Blanche.
Okay.
On the southwest coast, close to Port of Basque.
Yeah.
So that was a great experience. And then I stayed with them for almost 13 years. And then took a small detour to the airport authority at home. They were undergoing quite a bit of construction. Gave that a go. And then I came back to the electricity industry almost 11 years ago now. And I came to the Crown Corporation, so Newfoundland Labrador Hydro. And I think I've really found myself there. I did not know how much I would find satisfaction and drive in providing a service back, not only just in the electricity industry, which is super cool, but back to the people of the province. So I get a lot of satisfaction and drive and incentive in trying my best to deliver for the actual residents of the province.
Yeah, yeah. And again, you know, because the listener may not be familiar with the situation or the circumstances, could you talk a little bit about the kind of the critical role that Newfoundland and Labrador Hydro plays, both from an economic standpoint, but also, I mean, it's part of the fabric of the society, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so we're not a big province, about 540,000 people, I think the numbers are these days. We're essentially in every community. Mm-hmm. You know, we're in remote communities that are not interconnected, you know, communities that have kilowatts of load.
Yeah.
But we're also the major generator in the province and the major transmitter. Mm-hmm. And then we take the power and we sell it to Newfoundland Power, who's a private company, and they then do most of the distribution. We do mm-hmm. some. But we are, and we've been there for decades. So we have a significant history, both, you know, people employed in every community, essentially, but also just providing for that essential service in the province, in every area, every reach, that truly does reach every single home mm-hmm. in the province, whether we do the distribution, Newfoundland Power does the distribution. We've generated most of that power, transmitted right. most of it. But certainly we go much beyond our borders as well. Churchill Falls, which we run and is in Labrador, it supplies Quebec with 15% of its power.
Right.
That's a huge percentage.
Yeah.
We're selling down into New England. We're selling down into New York. So, you know, we have an incredible role within the province. And then financially, you know, we're returning value back to the province. But then we have a significant reach well beyond our borders as well. So we're quite proud of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we, you know, we're here because of the faces of the industry for National Electricity Month, June 2025. But last year, your company was also recognized by Electricity Canada with our first ever Extraordinary Service mm-hmm. Award. And that had to do with, as we termed it, for the bravery and innovation in the face of catastrophic wildfires. The Churchill Falls team at Newfoundland Labrador Hydro has been awarded our first ever Extraordinary Service Award. For the listener, mm-hmm. Maybe could you describe a little bit about what that extraordinary circumstance was? Because mm-hmm. it really was unprecedented in terms mm-hmm. of the challenge that was being faced.
Absolutely. This was it was new for us. I mean, every province has experienced wildfires, incredibly devastating in many circumstances. But this community, Churchill Falls, which is a company-owned town, so yeah. Hydro owns the town, we own the houses, we own the school, we own the grocery store, we run it in wow. support of the plant. So
right.
everything to do with that community, like we're kind of the mayor as well, right? Like we
yeah,
run
yeah.
the town.
Yeah.
Everything to do with the town. So that means the spouses, the children, they're our responsibility as well.
Right.
But fire services is very much a provincial responsibility. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we have done is we really do foster a really strong relationship with government. And I think that the outcomes of how we were able to work with government, I'll get into say some of the specifics about the fire last year, is really because we do have a great relationship with our provincial government.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so important just because of who we are. And in this instance, it really proved out. So we're monitoring wildfires like everyone does every year in the region, along with government, and the wildfire was approaching the town. And the pace and the speed at which it was moving was astounding.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe what we ended up doing was sort of a two-phase situation. We were preparing people. We actually had done a desktop exercise. What if we had to evacuate? What's that going to look like?
Right.
So we'd done a lot of preparation. But then the fire was approaching, and we said, okay, that's it. The folks in the town have to get out. And so we evacuated. This was the first time this town had been evacuated
mm-hmm.
Since it had been in, you know, really in place since the early 70s.
Right.
And so we're talking 50 plus years. So then it got to a point, but we had left about a dozen, or I can't remember, it was a dozen or two dozen so people back, just core operations and a couple of core security just to keep the plant running. But then we're like, it's not safe. And so, you know, between us and government, I mean, you had this 5,400 megawatt asset
mm-hmm.
and we had to walk away.
Mm.
And it was really, really tough. It wasn't just tough to think about protecting the asset. You had to think about their homes and all, but the life of the people that stayed behind obviously meant more.
Yeah.
Knowing the implication, if something happens to the plant, you have all of Labrador that would be without power.
Yeah.
Because Labrador is supplied.
Yeah.
15% of Quebec is supplied with it. If you had a catastrophic effect. So we were still, you know, with government and with other partners from across the other provinces helping deal with the fire.
Mm-hmm.
But we took all of the employees out. They went to Goose Bay. But what we did was we implemented engineering solutions urgently to help us monitor the plant and be able to have some form of control and some form of control. And it was really just impressive just to watch how this all happened when all of these folks were also still really worried about their homes, you know, because that's where they live.
Sure.
And so it was really impressive just to see everyone pull together, the ingenuity, how they prioritize things, how we cared for each other. We really cared for our employees and their families and their children, all that, as we as they were, you know, moved and we had to leave them out of town for a period of time. It has been one of the highlights of my career to kind of see how we pulled together, but how we still kept things functioning and care for the people.
Great. And justifiably, I think, 100%. Recognized by.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you, Jennifer, for taking a couple of minutes out of your day to chat about this. And once again, congratulations for you know, being recognized by your peers as you know, for your leadership in this space, and congratulations on being one of the faces of the industry in 2025.
Thank you. Well, I think I'm a face that represents many. So you never achieve the kinds of things that this organization achieves alone. So this is really representative of a lot of really good people.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Thanks.
My next guest on the podcast is
Dan Urban, Director of Procurement at SAS Power.
First off, welcome to the podcast and congratulations on being one of Electricity Canada's 2025 Faces of the Industry.
Francis, thank you. What an honor it was to be nominated and then, of course, to be picked by your esteemed panel. It's an absolute privilege and I thank you very much for that.
Well, listen, let's jump right into it, because I got to say, you know, when the team initially said to me, oh, and you know, one of our faces of the industry is somebody who makes supply chains interesting and sexy, I said, you got to be kidding. Supply chains?
That's, interesting? That sounds like how I describe myself. Thank you. Yeah, that's what I do.
But, you know, honestly, kind of where we are right now in this particular point in time, talking about supply chains is very relevant. It's been, you know, top of mind when I'm talking to members, when I'm talking to CEOs. It's been, you know, it's got to be really kind of since COVID-19, supply chains has been on the top of mind of everybody. And then now, of course, with, you know, trade issues popping to the fore. So how crazy has it been being in the supply chain space the last couple of years?
Yeah, it's been untenable at times, certainly, but you're absolutely right, Francis. Supply chain has been thrust to the forefront of a lot of leadership, you know, focus. And we take that really seriously. I think that supply chain enables our companies, it enables our industry, but we've been a little bit in the background, just making sure that our projects are being executed on time, on budget, making sure that our suppliers are being supported and advocated for. But in moments like these, as you mentioned, the pandemic, and certainly with, you know, our trade challenges with several nations, our leadership is being looked to from us. I love being someone that can offer some light in a very dark tunnel, and seeing the impact of what supply chain can really do locally and across Canada. It's such a huge opportunity. So I like to not lament and say these are hard times for us. I think these are elevating our ability to influence really good outcomes, right? So It's a positive situation for us, and I've appreciated the agency it's offered.
Yeah, because it is, you know, as you know, we've said, it is certainly a challenging time. Supply chains are in the spotlight, not simply because of the, you know, just the challenges that we've seen for the last several years from a timing standpoint, but the cross-border challenges as well. Oddly enough, today, you know, I'm catching you, probably you're in Regina.
I'm in Regina right now, yeah.
I'm in Washington, D.C.,
Awesome.
down here, actually talking about trade issues and so on. But yeah, you said there's a positive side to this. So let's talk a little bit about that, because I think you've got some pretty interesting stories in terms of what's been done to promote supply chains within Canada, to promote some partners that are local. Why don't you unpack that a little bit for some of the folks?
Well, first of all, I deserve zero individual credit. The amount of energy, the amount of community that comes together to grow our supply chain domestically and locally is a huge group. And it starts with our suppliers. The innovation that comes from the supplier community is really undeniable. And all we really have to do is harness it, allow for adoption of that innovation to grow within our organization. So, what I'll say is that local suppliers, Saskatchewan suppliers, and Canadian suppliers do great things. And too often we spend a lot of time worrying about just our own specific needs as an organization, as a province, as a region. And when you really start to collaborate and work together, you can create those positive business cases where companies in Canada can start to invest in themselves and really kind of grow their own capabilities and capacity to serve not just us, but everyone here. So there's only one way that you can really insulate yourself from supply chain risks. We learned a hard lesson during the pandemic. There's a lot of deprioritization going on in our industry. We all use the same suppliers, but we don't all have the same specifications. So a lot of people were finding suddenly we were competing against each other. Buyers were competing against each other for priority, right? The only way we can really protect ourselves from that is by making sure that the companies in our country and our provinces are actually there for us and prioritizing us. So in Saskatchewan, because to some degree, Saskatchewan's really unique as a power utility community, because we have a huge geographic region, a very small population to derive revenue from. The population density in our province is different than it is in many other provinces. But that doesn't mean that our supply chains are any less complex. My friends at Hydro-Québec and in Ontario and BC, we buy the same things. They just buy a bit more of it because they have a lot more people they have to serve than we do, right? So we all have the same kind of complexities, and there's amazing supply chain leaders across our country. But how can we start to buy the same things? How can we start to have kind of more, intentional conversations with the supplier community in Canada so they can start selling us what we need and we can rely less on out of country manufacturing, out of country providers, right? So that's kind of the focus that we've been going after right now. In Saskatchewan, we have a long history of growing domestic suppliers. We buy our transformers and our wire and cable and our structures for our power poles. We buy all that here because we've put an intentional effort into growing those industries within our own province. And because of that, they gave us that resilience to survive these moments, these hard times from the pandemic and trade conflict. So I want to keep fostering that, but I want to do it as a country. And Electricity Canada, your organization, Francis, is an amazing organization that helps us have those conversations. So.
Terrific. Hey, I'd want to unpack a couple of those and talk about maybe a couple of specific examples. But before we get to that, I got to ask you, and it's the silly question that I ask everybody who comes on the podcast. Dan, when you were a kid on the playground, did you always dream of, working in supply chain? What
Absolutely not.
was your journey? Tell us about your journey.
Well, thanks for asking. I will say this. When I was in university, I have a couple business degrees, but when I was in university, there wasn't even a supply chain discipline. There is now. I get a chance to go and speak to students nowadays that aspire to work at SaskPower Power and supply chain, which I love because there wasn't even a class in my entire undergraduate degree about supply chain. I was a marketer. I wanted to sell things. I wanted to create products. And it actually it took me to another provincial crown utility at SaskTel. SaskTel is different than SaskPower. They are a government crown, but they compete against world, multinational, telcos and cell providers and all that. I wanted to sell a consumer product. So I was a marketer. That was what my education was in. But I just really wanted to be in a leadership position. I aspired for leadership at that time. An opportunity came up to join to join the procurement function over there and be a manager of procurement. And trust me when I tell you, I had no idea what that meant. I Wikipedia'd what procurement was before the interview. You know, I had no idea. And I went into that interview. I thought I aced it. I did not. But, you know, there wasn't a lot of people, as you said at the very beginning of this conversation, making supply chain interesting and dynamic. And I think you said sexy, your words, not mine. That was the case back then. I don't think there's a lot of people that were going for that job. So I became a procurement manager, knowing very little about procurement. And within about 3 weeks, I was in love. I realized that supply chain is really what I wanted to be. As a kid on the playground, I wanted to be a businessman. I wanted to have 6 cell phones in my pocket, buying and selling and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's what I thought I would be when I grew up. And honestly, supply chain really checks a lot of those boxes.
I was going to say, that's basically what you're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. But what I really love about my role here is, I mean, I could work in private sector. I believe that that would be interesting too. I've always worked in public sector because I have this mentality, and I share this with a lot of the leaders in my organization. Rupen Pandya, our president, he talks about this with confidence. You know, having that public servant kind of mentality, that really floats my boat. That really is what kind of gets me up in the morning. I love that I have the ability to do good, prudent procurement work in my company. But the impacts have a huge impact on my province. We're a big economic impactor, and I love that too. So that's why I've really stayed and focused on public sector procurement and grown. And so I jumped over to SAS Power several years ago, as it's the largest government purchasing entity in the province. And we have some real juice here. We have some real capacity to make positive impacts in our province and across our industry. So that's my journey. I wanted to be a businessman, started as a marketer, took a job in procurement because I saw the word manager more than I saw the word procurement, honestly, and really decided, well, this is for me. And that was about 20 years ago at this point. I've been in procurement for a long time, and I've developed this. I call myself a procurement nerd because I really just love the function, the business function of supply chain and procurement.
Yeah, cool. Okay, hey, let's talk about some specifics, maybe some of the companies that you've been able to work with and partner with. Tell me about, and I see in my notes here, a company called Breck Construction.
Well, they're one of many companies that we've had the pleasure of really partnering with and then watching, just getting out of their way and watching them, you know, innovate and be intuitive with what we need as a company, what our province needs, and what other customers there needs, and just see them grow. Breck is an amazing organization, and they are actually led by and owned by a woman. And SAS Power has a focus. We've had a focus for a long time on Indigenous engagement and supplier development. We expanded that program to focus on diversity in general. And we launched a program to focus on women-owned business several years ago. And Breck was one of our kind of first women-owned businesses that we targeted with supplier development. Right. And, you know, in that time, I take no credit for the work that they've done. And Bobby Lynn, the president of their organization, has done leading that organization. But they have really aspired to grow their capabilities and expand what they do for us, from subcontracts and smaller scopes of work to being primary contractors and leading important, maintenance agreements for us in our power plants. And they have expanded. They work in other provinces now, which is truly what I'm looking for. I love being a seed that is that investment that allows local companies to, invest in themselves. But I don't want SAS Power to be their only customer or their entire focus. I want them to really broaden so they serve a lot of people and they serve a lot of provinces and a lot of my power utility friends, because then they really, that's really when you see the rocket fuel go into them growing their capabilities, right? So they're a real success story in Saskatchewan and abroad outside of our province too. And really, all we really did is just intentionally partner with them and make sure that they were prepared to bid, prepared to understand what our scope of work really looks like. I have a great supplier development team on my team that are focused on these Saskatchewan suppliers, Indigenous suppliers, and women-owned businesses. We really partnered with them and we really joined with them and said, you know, we want to improve your successes. We want to put you in a position to win. And they grabbed the brass ring and ran for it. So,
wow. Now, you'd mentioned indigenous procurement as well. That's been a focus, and I think a pretty big story for SaskPower, Power, hasn't it been?
Yeah, so for the better, for more than 12 years now, we've had not just a focus to prioritize Indigenous supplier growth and development in our province, but it's not just my team's goal. It's my whole company's goal. It's actually built into our scorecard at a corporate level. It's what my executive hold me accountable for instead of the other way around. And that's really allowed us to kind of unlock the true potential. And I can think of so many stories where we sat down with an economic development firm from an Indigenous community or maybe a tribal council, a group of Indigenous communities, with just a conversation about, hey, we have an intention. We have workers. We have a desire to grow. What kind of business should we get into right now? You know, and so SaskPower, we connect those dots and we say, well, this is an underserved, you know, area of our business. We don't have a lot of local or Indigenous participation, lower barriers to entry so you can get going on this. And, you know, let's start and let's build some momentum, give smaller scopes of work and just see those grow into bigger. And, you know, I can think of 10 years ago, those conversations, and now I'm working with companies that are huge organizations that have hundreds of employees and do this for not just SaskPower, but many communities. So, we every year we set a target for Indigenous spend, and every year we exceed that target. Last year we set the high water mark. Last year also, in partnership with my president and my executive vice president, we made a commitment that we're going to spend $1 billion over the next 10 years with Indigenous communities. And I have every reason to believe that we're going to accomplish that much sooner than 10 years from now. So we're doing great things, and it really starts and ends with the innovation of our Indigenous communities and partners that never cease to amaze me with where they are able to pivot and take advantage of where there's a need, and they stand up businesses, they acquire companies, they partner, and it's truly a Saskatchewan success story, and I see it across Canada, quite frankly, as well.
Right. Now, as we look to the future, there's talk of nuclear being part of Saskatchewan's future. What's that doing for really for you and for the team at SaskPower when you're thinking about supply chains?
Yeah. Oh, it's such a privilege to work at SaskPower because we're not that big, you know. So I get to be in charge of the procurement of everything and certainly the supplier development of everything. And that certainly includes standing up a nuclear organization. You know, it is something we're investigating, we're studying, we're aspirational about right now. We think that a nuclear future in Saskatchewan makes a tremendous amount of sense. But there hasn't been a new greenfield, new nuclear organization established in North America in decades, right? So becoming the first new nuclear organization in a very long time, working with a national regulator, forging partnerships with communities and regions that we don't currently have, you know, those kind of partnerships with. It's a huge opportunity. But I'll tell you, my province is so excited about the economic impacts. You know, my province is full of suppliers that do great work in our industry. They don't do a lot of great work in the nuclear industry, and they'd love to be part of that nuclear supply chain. Our friends over in Ontario and New Brunswick, and certainly in other regions in North America, we're talking about creating, you know, a pan-Canadian supply chain, a pipeline for supplier growth. If there really is a nuclear renaissance, you know, afoot, if there really is a real opportunity for nuclear to become broadly adopted across our nation and across our continent, we're going to need to have a lot more people supplying that and working in that sector as well. So, it's an honor, it's a privilege to try and build a nuclear supply chain and introduce a lot of companies into the supply chain mix. And I have a lot of confidence that we're going to be able to do it. We build a lot of power plants in Saskatchewan and Western Canada, and I don't see why we can't be building a lot of nuclear power plants. And then you factor in, where does uranium come from? A tremendous amount of uranium comes from the very mineral-rich province of Saskatchewan, right? So there's a lot of natural synergies with with their fuels coming from, and our ability to not just build nuclear power plants here, but to help Canada build nuclear power plants across our nation. So.
And you know, and the other thing, of course, that's been taking a lot of oxygen in the room has been, the tariff issues and U.S. trade uncertainty. Maybe for the listener, can you talk a little bit about, what that has meant for you and for supply chains? Have you had to be thinking about this differently because of the kind of the place we are right now with respect to trade uncertainty?
100%. I'll say that I have two missions as the leader of a very complicated and large supply chain here in the middle of Canada, which is a prudent management of my supply chain is always my job. How do I make sure that I'm paying fair market value and I'm delivering, those input costs into my company that keep our rates down and keep energy affordable and reliable for my province? That's my mission. That's my goal. That's what I do here. But also, how do we align underneath our government and certainly across Canada as a unified force on policy? How do we say it's not okay that these levers of international trade are being used to, harm or hurt or disrupt? Having an integrated supply chain with the United States is and has always been a really good way for us to insulate ourselves from supply chain risk. It makes a lot of sense. So as far as what's changed for us, I'm very happy to prioritize Canada and Saskatchewan in growing suppliers. But we've been doing that for a long time. This isn't new for us already. Inherently, it makes sense to work with local suppliers where you can. And inherently, it makes sense to work with suppliers that are from the United States where that is prudent to do so. But what I will say that was really kind of shocking, not only did this happened kind of quickly, and I don't think it was particularly well anticipated for obvious reasons. But we didn't really understand the downstream implications of our supplier supply chains, right? When I say I in Saskatchewan and at SAS Power, I don't work with a lot of American companies. I do work with a lot of Canadian companies that have American ownership, and I do work with a lot of Canadian companies, and they have supply chains that are heavily integrated within the United States, right? So I've had a conversation with a great many of our suppliers, and we have thousands of suppliers at SAS Power. We have thousands of suppliers at any power utility company. And a lot of them have told me they're struggling with the same thing. They don't exactly know the downstream implications of U.S. trade, disruptions. So prudently managing procurement, that's hard already. Trying to enact policies and processes that make sure that Canada is strong and resilient and resistant to these types of disruptions. That's a lot harder to do when I can't just, run a quick report in my system and say, these are the companies that are American and these are the companies that aren't, right? So, but it's a huge opportunity again, Francis, for us to say it is important for us to understand the downstream implications and just how where there is risk when these kind of disruptive things happen. So I think maybe we were a little bit too comfortable with not knowing this stuff, and I think this has been a catalyst that'll last for a very long time now, probably forever, for us to really say it's not just where are you from, it's where is your supply chain from as well. We're factoring that into our decision making too.
Hey, Dan, listen, I want to thank you for taking the time to jump on the podcast to chat a little bit. And you delivered on proving that supply chains can actually be interesting.
Thank you. Wow. I love it.
Yeah, well, and it shows. And once again, congratulations be for being selected basically by by your peers as as one of the recipients of our 2025 Faces of the Industry. Congrats and thanks for joining the pod.
Francis, thank you for your leadership and for your organization. Electricity Canada does great work. I certainly appreciate the committee that I'm part of, the Supply Chain Committee. Eric and Jay and those guys from your team are excellent, and they all deserve credit for supply chain leadership, and I'm honored to be part of it.
Great. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
See you soon. Bye.
And our third guest today is
Mohammed El Nozahi, Engineering Manager, EMT Studies, Independent Electricity System Operator, IESO.
Mohammed, first off, congratulations on being named one of the faces of the industry for 2025.
Thank you so much. That's a privilege.
Well, I think for the listener, Let me start with the obvious question. EMT.
Okay.
All right. So we're talking about electromagnetic transient and the work that you did particularly on the first comprehensive electromagnetic transient roadmap. So for the non-engineers out there, can you explain what electromagnetic transient and what a roadmap for EMT is?
So I will take a step back. So I will say, like, you know, the power system so far has been mostly like traditional generation, like nuclear, hydro. And now we are facing a new wave of new technologies, solar, wind, storage, and they are all interfaced by inverters. So we call these inverter-based resources, or IBRs, if you hear that. So our traditional modeling tools, basically, they were good for the previous generation of resources because their performance was dictated by physics, you know, how the machine was built. But as we interfaced more, or as we interconnected more of these new IBRs, we started to see issues like happening in places like California and Texas, where they are losing gigawatts of power for faults maybe like 300 kilometers away from the IBR. They are reacting to other faults, and they are tripping. And the question, okay, but we did our studies. But the problem is the tools that we have, they are not suited for these kind of resources.
So they're based upon the technology of what we were using 50 years ago to generate as opposed to today.
Exactly. So new technologies, they require new tools. And these IBRs, the performance is not based, again, on the physics. It's based on the firmware, the code that's embedded into them.
Okay.
So that's a good and a bad thing. The bad thing, if you cannot model that, you don't know how they will behave. You assume they will behave like traditional generators, which is not the case. But if you can model it, then you can predict the performance and you can actually enhance their performance they can provide. So it's a mixed blessing. If you model it, then you can get superior performance. If you don't model it, you get unexpected bad surprises. And again, like, we had so many events in North America and Europe. So the EMT basically is enabler for these technologies.
Okay.
Electromagnetic transient tools, the good thing about them, they come with, you can embed these resources, you can get the firmware, put it into the software, predict their performance exactly down to the microsecond level. You can also, our traditional tools, they are used, they're only based on the 60 hertz, which is the fundamental frequency. But these resources, many of their problems, they happen at non-60 hertz, subsynchronous oscillation, subsynchronous
problems. Yes, of course, subsynchronous, yes.
So our tools, they cannot capture that. Okay. But EMT,
because our tools were built basically for 60. For 60 megahertz.
Again, and they were built for that for a reason, because the existing technology was technology. All 60 hertz. But now that's a new era. So we need new tools. And basically, we learned from other jurisdictions. When we started our efforts in Ontario to get, you know, our procurement efforts to increase our capacity and energy supply in Ontario, like, we did more proactive approach. Okay, we are adding many of these resources, but basically we know these resources can be good and can be bad, depending on how you study them, on how you model them. And that's why we went with the EMT. So when I was, like, you know, tasked to start the EMT initiative at the ISO like 2.5 years ago, we didn't even have a software license in the building. So we went ahead, we got the software, we built, like, we developed a team of experts. Now we embedded the ISO into our process, because it's not just I'm going to change everything we have been doing for the past 40 years and just go and change. It doesn't work like that. You have to change the process. You have to do the change management that. So we did all of that. We did the validation studies for 3 gigawatt of storage technologies in Ontario. We built one of the largest EMT models in the world. So basically what we were doing plant level studies, studying a specific plant.
Okay.
Now we are building a model for the Ontario system, for the entire Ontario system. That's the good thing about EMT. The bad thing is EMT is very computationally intensive, as you can imagine, because you are simulating small time step running, you know, all of these firmware into one computer program. So we are, like, in parallel with that, we are getting two supercomputers, 96 core each,
Oh, right.
Running them
parallel. I was going to say, if you're just running this on VMs, it just wouldn't work. You couldn't spin up enough virtual machines to be able to do this.
But now we are doing that. We are cutting the system into parallel cases. We are working with the MHI, Manitoba Hydro International. They are the developers of the PSCAD software, software we are using. So we went directly to that developer. We worked with them. We built our system. We divide the system into parallel cases so that we can run it. And again, this is considering in Ontario so far, just the traditional machines, we have 400 generators in the model. That's significant computational burden.
Yeah.
So, and the good thing is this was done in-house. Like, you know, all the expertise for that, our team now, it's in-house. All the work has been done in-house. We are building that expertise locally here in Ontario at ISO. And I think we are doing so well that now we are starting to influence the industry. So now, like in the NERC drafting teams, I am participating.
I was going to ask about that because you're not doing this in a vacuum, right?
No.
This isn't just IESO. You've got the other ISOs and the RTOs, and you've got NERC that's been looking at these sorts of questions. So how do you work with NERC? You're part of the drafting team?
Yeah. At ISO, like, you know, we have that mentality. Instead of waiting for the standards and waiting for others to decide our future, we go ahead and we decide our fate ourselves.
Right.
We influence the process. We bring our requirements there.
Right.
And that's what we usually do. Like, you know, like I've participated in couple drafting teams, like multiple people from the ISO, like PRC 30, PRC 29, and now in MOD 26. These are all standard. So we are bringing our expertise there.
Mm-hmm.
We're bringing our requirements there. And we are also trying to shape the industry for the future.
Right.
And not just the NERC, like the IEEE P2800 standard.
Sure.
We are also in that like couple people from the ISO there.
So you want to make sure when the standards finally do get developed, they're exactly consistent with the work that you've already been undertaking.
They meet our, because basically the word, like we usually in Ontario, we have stricter, like more strict standard than the NERC. We usually say that NERC standards are the floor,
right,
not the ceiling.
Yeah.
We can always go, and we usually go, but now we are trying, okay, let's increase, you know, that floor for everybody.
Yeah.
Because we are all connected in the Eastern Interconnection.
Absolutely.
It doesn't make sense if we have more strict standard than someone else.
Absolutely.
Because we are all in that
every
together.
Time we've seen a major outage, we recognize the interconnectivity. And
exactly.
Yeah. We're only as reliable.
So we can't, like you mentioned, we can't be in a vacuum. We have to work collectively with everyone. We have to raise the bar for the entire industry. And I think that's what we are doing in Ontario and at ISO.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, something I ask everybody, Mohammed, that comes on the podcast is about their journey. And so my joke to you is, when you were a kid on the playground, did you always dream of being an EMT specialist? What was your journey to your role today at the IESO?
Yeah. That's actually, I used to dream when I was 4. I used to dream, like, you know, but not about EMT, because apparently there was no EMT at the time. Like, I was thinking, like, how these wires, you know, would power the entire house. And I was very curious about that. And then even when I went to high school, you know, my interest started to shift. So I became into electronics, building power supply, circuits, you know, playing with all the magnets. And then I'm like, okay. And then I got into programming, you know, I'm like from the old generation, started with basics and then C, C++. And so I did all that.
Yeah.
And then I went into engineering. And now actually that's a dream work for me, because, you know, you see now the best of both fields are coming together.
Yeah.
You are having still the power system, but it's powered by all of these electronic devices, IBRs, which are programmed to give you the performance. So it's the best of both worlds coming together.
Yeah.
So it, like, literally it's my dream job. You know, my childhood.
It's almost like bringing hardware and software together.
Exactly. Yeah, and that basically what motivated me. Like, I went, I did my PhD at the University of Waterloo.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I worked for 3 years in mining.
Okay. Yeah.
So it was in the Diavik Diamond Mine in the Northwest Territories. And it had to do with that, because it was at the time the largest hybrid microgrid in the world. So it had wind farm.
So you were working for the mining company, but you were doing
electrical engineering stuff.
And I was doing, so you had, like, a microgrid up there?
We had a microgrid. We have 50 MVA of diesel and 10 megawatt of wind.
Okay.
So we had tons of wind penetration. So that gave me lots of expertise. You know, I would say even more in field expertise.
Mm-hmm.
And then I joined the ISO 8 years ago.
Right.
And the journey continued.
Yeah, and it's kind of like back to the future now. When
yeah.
The kind of work that you're doing today is kind of a callback to the work that you were doing in Northwest Territories.
Yes.
That's very cool. Listen, just as a, you know, as a bit of a kind of a geeky question for you, supercomputer that you're going to be running this on, or you're already running on it, what is it? Like, let's talk specs for the real nerds out there. What is this system that you're running?
It's a Threadripper, AMD Threadripper.
Threadripper?
Yeah, AMD? 96.
Okay.
But we are getting two of these, and we can interconnect them in parallel. So literally ending up with 192 are using some protocol called InfiniBand. So we can use that protocol to run PSCAD over two computers without much communication
right.
overhead.
Yeah.
So, and then the rest of the specs, like I think the hard drive is 4 terabyte. We don't need a lot of storage
okay.
space.
Okay. The RAM, it's more processing as opposed
yeah,
to storage.
Yeah, the RAM is significant, actually.
I guess,
512, I think.
Okay.
Gigabyte of RAM.
Of RAM, yeah.
And the VGA card, yeah, unfortunately, I can't play any games there. It's very, we don't need VGA, like right. GPU processing power. So
yeah.
I think we went with the, you know, standard one. We didn't
right.
Expand on the VGA. But then there's also the work that goes into the background, like building mm-hmm. that system, big system, and then cutting it in chunks, because you know when you parallel process the power system, it's not that simple, because something that happens at that end of the line, it impacts the other end of the line.
Sure.
But when you're doing parallel processing, that's not the case. So
yeah.
how you do that, that's you know the tricky part. So you have to basically consider the propagation delay. There is lots of math and lots of theory that goes behind that. So you have to go to transmission line where
yeah.
the I don't want to get into the weeds, but where the transmission delay is significant, that you can decouple both systems and then they
mm-hmm.
are, you can parallel process them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you like, and it makes sense, something that happening in Bruce County, you know, doesn't impact the generator in Toronto, for
Absolutely.
Example.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
there is physical meaning for it, and there is also the math behind it.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
we put all of that in one software, and then, you know, we set it up, and then literally after we get this ready, like you run, like you click and you get the EMT results for the Ontario system,
mm-hmm.
not just for a single plant.
Right, right. Well, listen, I want to, you know, congratulate you once again for being honored as one of the faces of the industry for 2025, being recognized by your peers for your leadership in this space. So congratulations, Mark.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for taking the time to sit down and chat.
Thank you.
For those that have been with the podcast since the beginning and those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. Tune in for future episodes, and please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen, and let me know what you think of the Flux Capacitor. You can find me through our website at electricity.ca, on LinkedIn, and on Instagram as The Brad Bradley. Until next episode, let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.